All of the charges, three on each side of the bridge, were in position, set to detonate from a radio signal. John looked across to the other side of the bridge. Clinging to one of the girders there, as John did on his side, Michael was ready. John looked at the black-faced Rolex submariner on his left wrist. All they needed was Paul's signal. This was taking too long, and the longer it took, the more chance there was it would go wrong. Natalia had full flexibility in her fingers, if not full feeling. Her fingertips still tingled as she moved them. As soon as the two men retreated toward the barricade, Paul walking on with them for a moment, she retrieved the balisong, then let her dress fall back. She held the knife, the lock off, the handle in her right hand, shielded by her left. She desperately wanted to cut the bonds from her wrists, but to do so now might be premature. Instead, she let one handle half drop, sawing with the balisong's primary edge against the ropes, but not cutting all the way through. The rope was old, so it would be dry and cut away easier. Once one cord of the rope was cut through, she could pull her wrists free. Natalia looked at Annie. Annie nodded that she had her knife as well.
Move your asses, girls, on the double.
Bowing their heads slightly, the two women started moving slowly over the old concrete bridge.
Hurry it up, damn it!
When they neared Paul, he grabbed them both and pushed them forward roughly. The blankets that had been wrapped around Natalia against the cold fell from her shoulders. When she looked back toward it, Paul gave her another shove.
Sorry. Stupid bitch! Don't want the damn blanket, then freeze your ass off!
They were nearing the barricade. Paul grabbed Annie and Natalia, pulling them together back to back. This was so they could help each other with the ropes on their wrists if need be. Natalia looked toward the barricade. The two men who accompanied Paul and then went back ahead of him were gone, presumably to get Boris. She lowered her eyes, sawing through the turn of rope all the way. Natalia was cold and stiff from standing there in the cold. She really didn't know just how long it had been, but her wrists were free, and she could tell by feeling behind her that Annie's wrists were free as well. A truck, almost a brand new Eden Army issue, was pulling up on the far side of the barricade. The two men she'd seen with Paul jumped down from the back, the truck parked at an angle across the bridge. Then a man climbed down out of the passenger side of the cab. He was big, fat, and dirty-looking. He wore a heavy coat that looked to be made of sheepskin, cinched at its enormous waist with a wide belt, a pistol holster on either side of it, the pistols set for cross-draw, cartridge belts crisscrossed over his chest. He wore a black beard, so long it was nearly to the center of his chest. As he started forward toward the barricade, she could tell he stood well over 6 feet. She guessed his weight at close to 300 pounds.
And who the hell are you to order me to come and see two damn pieces of ass? Yeah, you, damn it!
Hey, you don't want to see him, no big deal. I'll move on and sell him someplace else.
The hell you will!
Paul stood his ground, his pistol still in his hand. The big man came through an opening made for him in the barricade. His stride so long, it looked almost as if he could have crossed from one side of the river to the other without needing a bridge to keep his feet dry.
Blue eyes, huh?
Boris walked straight up to Natalia, past Paul, grabbed Natalia by the neck with his right hand, and almost lifted her off the ground.
Let me see him, bitch.
Natalia looked right at him. If he held her like this much longer, she'd have to try to kill him because she couldn't breathe.
Keep your hands off till you own her, man.
The man's breath flowed over his yellow teeth like swamp gas. He let go of Natalia's neck, and she let herself fall, dropping to her knees, leaning forward. On her knees, she was even less to be noticed, less of a possible threat.
I don't give no 6 rifles apiece for no damn piece of ass. I can take these from you right now. 3 rifles for both of them, and the drugs you want. That's my deal, man. Take it or leave it.
Boris, huh? You a Russian?
So what? You want the 3 rifles or you want to be dead?
What if I can get you more women like this?
Virgins?
Virgins.
Hell, for a steady supply of virgins, which you ain't got, asshole. But I'd swap you a rifle apiece and all the drugs you want. Get high as the moon. I don't give a shit.
Paul touched his left hand to the back of his neck as though rubbing away a cramp. Natalia was waiting for that signal. Through his left earpiece, John heard the signal. One beep, then two, then one, then two. Paul was activating the radio signaling device located under the collar of his shirt. John gave his son a thumbs-up signal, and they both started to climb.
You know, these two women, they're worth a lot to me. Maybe I ought to take him to the land pirates.
Paul stabbed his pistol toward Boris. In one move, Natalia sprang to her feet, ripped the gag from her mouth, and with her follow-through, slashed her nails across the fat man's face, grabbing his right ear and twisting his powerful neck left. The point of the balisong pressed against his carotid artery behind and below his right ear.
Unconscious in 5 seconds and dead in 12 if you move. I just as soon you moved.
John flipped over the railing. The scoremasters came into his hands as his feet hit the bridge surface.
Hold it!
11 men switched their attention from the other end of the bridge to John and went for their weapons. John planned ahead, arranging with Michael to hit the bridge the instant after he heard John shout. Michael was on the bridge, an assault rifle in his right hand, the .44 Magnum Model 629 4-inch gleaming in his left.
Move and you die.
Two of the men moved anyway, the driver of the truck and one of the men beside the barricade.
Truck!
The Detonic Scoremasters bucked once each in his hands as Rourke wheeled toward the barricade. The man dropped before the assault rifle could fire. The report from Michael's assault rifle echoed off the bridge's metal struts. No one else moved.
Natalia, get that thing into the truck! Annie, get his weapons and toss him over the side into the river! Shoot his kneecaps out if he causes any trouble! He just needs to be able to talk, not walk!
Michael, a gun still in each hand, started herding the remaining 9 men toward the center of the bridge. In minutes at the most, the rest of Boris the Slaver's men would be coming, and John Rourke didn't care to wait around to see them. Natalia locked 3 sets of disposable plastic restraints around Boris's massive wrists, her knife to his ear as Annie secured his ankles.
You need a tongue to talk and one ear to listen. So this one is expendable if you move.
Yo!
Go ahead! Call me something and see how fast you start losing body parts.
He shut his mouth. Annie finished with his ankles and jumped down from the back of the truck, a blanket wrapped around her shoulders. Natalia jumped to the bridge floor.
Go up to the cab with Paul. I'll join you in a minute.
All right.
But give me Paul's other Browning.
Annie passed the 9mm to her.
It's hot.
Right.
Natalia glanced down at the pistol as she settled it in her hand. Cocked and locked. There had been 13 rounds plus one in the chamber, and Annie fired 2. 12 rounds, 9 men. Natalia flipped the balisong closed, left-handed, and dropped it in the side seam pocket of her dress. She started toward the 9 men at the center of the bridge. One of them was the man who talked so big while she'd been bound and gagged. Michael and John looked a bit surprised as she approached.
We're running out of time, Natalia.
Then these things who call themselves men had better hurry or I will shoot each one of them.
She looked at the 9 men who stood with their hands clasped over their heads.
Hear that? I am in a hurry! Remember how you shed your weapons?
Their guns and knives were in a pile on the bridge, near the far railing.
Let's see you shed your clothes in the same way! Be quick or be dead!
Some of the men looked at one another, then looked at her. Natalia pointed the high power at the biggest of the 9 men.
Guess where I will shoot you!
They started undressing. Michael hurled the guns and knives taken from the slavers over the bridge rail and into the river. Most of the guns were post-war and in terrible condition. The knives were big and flashy and of poor quality. The last of the weapons tossed away, Michael looked toward the center of the bridge. The last of the 9 men was down to nothing. Time was running out, but Natalia owed herself this, Michael realized.
Now, I want all of you to hold hands and form a circle. Box to the center. Move!
What the hell we gonna do now?
The 9 men did as she ordered, looking stupid, just as she wanted. Michael looked at his father. John stood, a .45 still in each hand.
Now, you will walk that way toward the far end of the bridge. The first man who breaks the circle dies! Start walking! Go on, walk!
Tripping over each other, but holding hands as though their lives depended on it, they started moving.
Faster! Come on!
Michael Rourke, shaking his head, smiled and started for the truck. Michael helped Natalia up into the cab of Paul's truck. The gesture, however unnecessary, was the gentlemanly thing to do. John ran forward along the passenger side of the Eden military truck they were stealing from the slavers, climbed aboard, one foot in the cab, the other hanging free, his body weight on the open door. his right hand holding the radio detonator.
We're rolling!
The truck carrying Michael and Natalia was already off the bridge and on the semi-paved excuse for a road leading away from it, gathering speed. John looked back. The nine naked men were running for their lives now. Vehicles of all descriptions raced onto the bridge from the far end. Some of the naked men pointed behind them toward the near end of the bridge. The vehicles drove out onto the bridge, driving four across, filling the bridge from one side to the other. Shots rang out, but too far away for any accuracy. John looked at the detonator switch in his right hand.
Daddy? Are you going to...
I'm holding out for maximum effect, Annie! Just another few seconds!
The lead element of the enemy vehicles was approaching the near end of the bridge, coming up fast. John flipped the release from the protective cover. He put his thumb over the red button and pushed.
1001? 1002? 1003?
John Rourke didn't throw away the detonator because doubtless he would need it again. The near end of the bridge collapsed inward, men and equipment careening through the air as the bridge fell on and around them. John swung into the cab and pulled the door closed. He put his arm around his daughter's shoulders.
On to bigger and better things.
The trail used by the smugglers and slavers who dealt with the land pirates was not through the Rift Valley, but along the plateau to its west. Much of the land here was radioactive or chemically contaminated. But by trial and error, the smugglers and slavers found a safe route. But it could be traveled by horseback alone. The electrical storms that whipped across the plateau on either side descended without warning, sometimes lacerating the barren ground with heavy rains. Sometimes electrical activity alone would neutralize the electrical system of any vehicle the smugglers and slavers used. So teams of horses, four abreast, as many as 12 animals in all per vehicle, were used to tow engineless trucks that carried in plunder and carried out women from the stronghold of the land pirates. Boris was left to Natalia and Annie to interrogate, and whatever they threatened to do to him, Paul didn't want to know. Boris proved a font of information. Like bullies everywhere, without his friends to back him up, he was a coward. The tapes made of his answers during the interrogation provided even more information than they expected. Indeed, Martin Zimmer was with the land pirates. For years, Zimmer let them exist, even helped them, but now he was forming a formal alliance. With promises of the latest in Eden military equipment and a steady supply of women and anything else they wanted from Eden, he was consummating an arrangement by which the land pirates would systematically hit every settlement in the wildlands. The objective, as far as Boris knew, was to kill anyone who might oppose Martin Zimmer, kidnap the usable women and kill the rest, along with the children who were too young for sexual or other uses. Then he would impress the healthy men into the service of Eden. Boris explained he knew many of the details because he was trying to work an alliance with the land pirates to get in on the action and make a profit. Zimmer wanted to assemble an army in the west before he attacked the Allies, an army that would cover his back. Boris also revealed that the route used by the land pirates through the Rift Valley was secure not so much because it was a secret, but because of the plasma energy weapons installed along its length. The weapons, energy cannons, were programmed to fire automatically when motion sensors hidden along the walls of the Rift Valley detected movement. When the land pirates exited or entered, the defense system shut down in stages, but never completely off. Intelligence data corroborated that the larger vehicles used by the land pirates were enormous mobile fortresses almost the size of World War II aircraft carriers. They moved over any obstacle their sheer momentum and weight did not crush on a system of independently operating treads. Each of the treads dwarfed those used in 20th century tanks. The land pirates possessed insufficient technology to build such vehicles or program computer-controlled weapons, but Eden did. According to Boris, agents of Eden actually controlled the land pirates. The vehicles were built in Eden and were a part of a fleet of hundreds of such vehicles built in secret, ready to deploy against the Allies. Paul studied Latin 5 days a week in high school. At last, he finally remembered something he'd been trying to recall since his last awakening. It was about Martin Zimmer's name. In Latin, Martin meant the warlike. It seemed to be a name that fit. Annie was glad to be back in her own clothes, her skirt a respectable length. She remembered the lovely young Chinese agent who rode side saddle and tried to teach Annie to do the same.
Could have done it, but what was the sense? Riding astride is the most practical way to get from one place to the other on horseback. Someday there might be a world in which I can ride for pleasure, try riding side saddle. Not in this world.
After two nights of camping in the wildlands without even so much as a hermetically sealed tent, Annie felt positively grubby.
I could probably comb my teeth. And I don't even want to think about my hair. But this is my job as much as it is Daddy's, Paul's, Michael's, or Natalia's.
She noticed subconsciously feelings from her father about this man named Martin Zimmer. The nearer they came to the land pirate stronghold, the greater sense of unease she felt. Last night, in their dark and cold camp, the electrical activity in the sky became maddeningly intense. Under cold rains, her father outlined their plan.
This Martin Zimmer, whoever he is getting ready for war. If he attacks the Allies, eventually it becomes nuclear weapons. Intelligence data indicates he has gas and biological weapons as well. The Allies won't have any choice but to defend themselves with their own nuclear weapons.
Why does Daddy call this man by his first name rather than calling him Zimmer?
The feelings were stronger in her, as if someone were invading her thoughts without trying. Annie urged her horse ahead along the track that paralleled the Rift Valley, where once the Mississippi flowed. This was once the land of Mark Twain and his Huck Finn, Tom Sawyer, and Becky. But in another few hours' ride, it would be the stronghold of the land pirates. John had already formulated a plan, and if the terrain, as the talkative Boris described it, were close enough in reality, they could have a decent chance of making it inside the stronghold. Escaping was another question, but John had plans for that as well. Again, very dependent on Boris's information.
Martin Zimmer. What is it about Martin Zimmer? It's not any sixth sense message. It's something powerful, inevitable. It is logic. It is necessity.
John urged his mount ahead with his knees and heels. Natalia's mind settled on the question of Martin Zimmer.
John calls him Martin and nothing else. And what of the story Hilda told us about the old village woman? She scrawled the devil into the snow and then carefully set a coin with the image of John Rourke in the center of the D. The cult of personality Martin Zimmer built around John's legend. It doesn't make sense that an evil man would so exalt a man who was good. Martin is clearly a Nazi. Even bore the surname of Dietrich Zimmer. The man responsible for the woes besetting us now. Why would a Nazi spawn a cult of personality around a man who, philosophically, could most closely be described as an objectivist? A man who spent his entire life fighting the very sort of tyranny Martin himself stands for.
What seemed irrational, Natalia learned very long ago, to someone somewhere was rational.
Why did Martin elevate John to the rank of some historical demigod when they are so diametrically opposed philosophically? Is it just a cruel joke?
Natalia checked the lady's Rolex on her left wrist. In a very little while, they would know. It was a citadel, the stronghold of the land pirates. John had watched it for nearly 24 hours, memorizing every feature. If evidence had been lacking, linking the government of Eden with the land pirates, here it was now. The fortress was fabricated of modern synth concrete, not something whipped up in the wildlands by men who were little more technologically advanced than Middle Ages barbarians. John would have to gamble, and considering that the lives of his wife Sarah, his son Michael, and perhaps all their lives hung in the balance, it was the biggest gamble of his life. Michael Rourke walked down along the path, his parka open despite the cold, so that he would be visibly armed and could get to his pistols. If his father's plan did not work, he wanted access to his guns, even though he would die. At least he would kill a few of the land pirates before he went down. The two Berettas were in their shoulder rig, slinging a 92F below each armpit. The 4-inch Metalife Custom Model 629 rode in the cross-draw holster between his navel and his left hip. He wore the knife made for him by old Jan the Swordmaker as well. He came down from the path and started walking toward the guard post on the north wall of the citadel. Eventually, someone would notice him. The electronic security that comprised the early warning system of the stronghold's integrated perimeter defense was disarmed in two locations, thanks to Natalia and Paul. They bridged it rather than interrupting it. Chances were, no one knew.
Within the next second or two, the guards on the wall will notice. Then it'll start. Hope Dad's right.
Hey! What the?
Three guards on the wall brought assault rifles to their shoulders.
I am Martin Zimmer. The man who negotiates with your leaders is an imposter. Shoot at me and all of Eden will crush you.
The crush you line was something he extemporized on the spot.
Not bad.
John, using the modern German equivalent of ninja climbing claws, scaled the synth concrete wall of the citadel. He reached the top and peered over. As he predicted, human security was all looking toward the north wall where Michael would be announcing himself just about now. The cameras were aimed at the outside perimeter to compensate for poor vigilance on the part of the human guards, not on the height of the wall itself. Every video system had dead spots, and after a day's worth of observation, John plotted a route to the wall that one man could follow, taking advantage of the dead spots. He remained undetected by the cameras. John went over the wall and down, ridding himself of the climbing claws. Quickly, he moved along the wall and into the shelter of a cupola that his observation indicated covered a stairwell. From one of the Musette bags, he took an electronic probe sensing device developed at Midway. It was a bug detector designed to pick up electronic activity. This one had a much greater scanning radius range between low and high-end signals and could detect activity up to a distance of 50 yards. Rourke held the German assault rifle in his right fist, the probe in his left, as he first tested, then started down the concrete and steel staircase. 5 steps down, he detected an electronic sensor pulsing intermittently near the base of the stairs. John slowed. As he neared the sensor, he was able to determine the position. There were actually 2 transmitters and 2 receivers located on the sides of the stairwell. Slung around his neck, below his chin, were a set of goggles. These too were developed at Midway, designed to allow divers to penetrate electronically secure areas. Rourke pulled up the goggles and activated their power unit. Like night vision goggles, the image they presented appeared digitized and wasn't ideal for detailed viewing. But these goggles were designed to receive electronic signals and translate them to visual signals. With the goggles in place, he could monitor the patterns of the signal beams. They looked like pencil-thin beams of light, and they crisscrossed. Had he not seen them, it would have been impossible to evade them. Interrupting one of the signals would doubtless sound an alarm of some sort at the security center. But with the goggles, and with extreme caution and considerable difficulty considering his height, John dropped to hands and knees on the stairs and began to crawl between the beams. Michael was surrounded by men who gave the concept of looking evil a whole new meaning.
You dead motherfucker!
Michael looked at the man, well over 6 feet, bearded and burly, armed with a pre-war shotgun and 2 pistols, and forced himself to smile.
The next man who says something like that to me loses his tongue or his life. Whichever amuses me more. Take me to where this imposter pretends to be Martin Zimmer. Now!
Natalia Anastasia Tyomarovna flipped over the synth concrete snow fence and ran along it toward the massive doors. Evidently, the land pirates had a raid planned. There were more personnel in the incredibly massive garage complex at the rear base of the stronghold than she had thought there would be. On the plus side, out of the 6 incredibly huge vehicles garaged in the system of structures, 2 of them had engines running. The walled stronghold of the land pirates was almost 1 mile square. The northern approach that John took was set on higher ground. The southern approach stretched out over a valley. A garage formed the foundation. Natalia peered inside. The mobile fortresses of the land pirates were not the size of World War II aircraft carriers, but they were larger than any land vehicle she could have imagined. Their main decks were easily the size of an American football field, in length and width. There were helicopter landing pads, it appeared, although she could not see beyond the main deck's perimeter. At least 2 Eden gunships rode on each of the mobile fortresses.
What are those for? Surely none of the land pirates know how to fly.
Below the main deck, she saw smaller vehicles, the size of conventional tanks, parked in rows. She also picked out a system of sub-decks with gun mounts visible at various locations. These would be plasma energy cannons. Natalia saw missile arrays as well. The land pirates might conceivably need energy cannons to do their work of plundering, but not missiles, because these were obviously surface-to-air ordnance, and no one in the wildlands had air power. But the Allies did. Huge cranes, attached to the main decks of the fortress, raised more gun batteries into position. Natalia saw men in military uniform moving about within the complex. Some uniforms clearly those of the Eden armed forces. The other uniforms, black, bore swastika armbands. The land pirates themselves seemed a disgusting lot, as foul-appearing as the slavers, but better armed in many cases. A movement behind her startled her, even though the source of the movement was what she expected, Paul and Annie joining her. Paul, except for his play-acting with the slavers and an occasional burst of anger, was very temperate of speech, but not in all situations.
Holy shit!
Michael walked, surrounded by a dozen sentries as he crossed the stronghold's courtyard. But, so far at least, they weren't 100% certain he was not Martin Zimmer, because not a one of them dared attempt or even suggest that he be disarmed. Under the circumstances, he was no danger to them.
Damn! Dad's plan is working.
What worried Michael was that his father's plan was working as well as it was, because that meant the premise for the plan was correct. Martin Zimmer must be his, their, physical duplicate.
How the hell did that happen?
Michael threw his shoulders back and kept walking. Paul Rubinstein settled his cap on his head, looked from side to side to be certain he was unobserved, then stood up and immediately started walking toward the nearest of the mobile land fortresses. Paul carried the Browning high power under the Eden uniform tunic he wore. John planned ahead, as always. He arranged for the Eden Armed Forces uniforms, then directed the group to wear them under their Arctic gear and snow smocks for their pre-dawn infiltration. Dumbstruck by its size, Paul nevertheless approached the beast. The treads themselves rose nearly half Paul's height in thickness. The wheels on which the treads set stood as tall as a small house from before the night of the war. The main deck towered more than 100 feet above him. There would be several entrances to a vehicle of such size, but the one he walked toward, with a gangplank like a battleship, was busy. Men came and went constantly. There were no guards. Paul passed an Eden officer wearing lower rank designation than he wore, and the officer saluted him with an outthrust right hand. Paul returned the salute. The green uniformed man disappeared around a stack of crates marked high explosive. There were other uniforms here, those that were black and sported swastika armbands on the left sleeve, but he encountered no one wearing such a uniform. A half dozen land pirates, grubby-looking men, heavily armed, exited the land fortress along its gangplank. Paul kept walking toward the entrance. The land pirates, dressed in pieces of Eden battle uniforms and a motley collection of mismatched garments, walked past him. One of them nodded. Paul nodded back. Paul reached the foot of the gangplank and paused for a split second. Annie and Natalia would be coming along as soon as he created his diversion. They needed the cover of a diversion to get them aboard, despite the Eden uniforms they wore. On close inspection, they would obviously be noticeable as women, and there were no women in the Eden Armed Forces, nor certainly among the forces of the land pirates. Women held positions as teachers, secretaries, factory workers, but nothing beyond that in Eden. A dramatic step backwards. Paul started up the gangplank. The interior of the land pirate stronghold was much as Michael imagined it would be. There were long corridors, dormitory-style sleeping rooms leading off from the corridors, storage rooms, and weapons vaults. Women, dressed in rags, some visibly shivering in the cold and dampness, slunk about the place carrying loads of wash or food. The one commonality among them, the look of terror in their eyes. At the end of one of the corridors stood a large assembly hall, dining tables ranked along it, with chairs enough to seat more than 1,000. With his 12-man escort surrounding him, Michael walked along its length toward large doors set at the center of the far wall. Annie crouched beside Natalia. She shivered with the cold because she wore no Arctic gear, just a man's Eden military uniform. Annie watched the main deck of the nearest of the mobile fortresses for signs of Paul.
Honey, be careful.
If Paul reached the main deck without being challenged for papers or identification, he would drop a plastique charge into one of the tanks, turning it into a giant shrapnel grenade. In the ensuing confusion, Annie and Natalia would get aboard the war wagon. John stopped. The detection unit he carried revealed no further electronic barriers, at least not within range. But his hearing and normal night vision revealed something else. For the past several minutes, he had been moving through a huge basement storage area, a synth fuel dump, enormous tanks full of it on all sides of him. But the sound he heard was not mechanical. It was the sound of men talking, the guttural quality of their speech as he slowly, silently approached the origin of the sounds, suggesting they were land pirates.
Good.
Under the circumstances, he was happy they were here. Paul stepped out onto the main deck of the enormous vehicle.
This thing is as big as a frickin' football field.
Six of Eden's latest helicopter gunships stood secured to the deck. Each of the gunships seemed equipped with a full missile array in pods located to port and starboard. Paul doubted any conventional explosives would have a sufficiently serious effect against one of these vehicles. In pre-war dollars, to build even one of these would cost well over $1 billion, he guessed. But Eden was big on taxation. Paul walked toward the nearest of the rows of tanks. The deck plates below his feet seemed somehow different. He looked at them more carefully and realized he was walking across a massive ramp. The ramp, set into the deck, could apparently be extended out and down like a prefabricated military bridge section for the use of the tanks as they left the main deck and returned. He made a mental note about the ramps, trying to think of a way to sabotage one at some future date, if there ever were a future date. The immediate job at hand was to blow up a tank. Eden military personnel, land pirates, and the black-clad swastika armband-wearing Nazis were everywhere, all busily engaged in what seemed like last-minute preparations for an operation. This was not going to be a raid against some hapless hamlet, but a full-scale military deployment. Was Martin Zimmer on the brink of beginning his war against the Allies? Paul reached the tank. Beneath his uniform tunic, Paul carried several charges of the latest German plastique in various sizes for various contingent uses. He selected the largest of the charges, then climbed aboard the tank.
Yo!
Without turning around, Paul knew it could only be a Nazi who would shout like that to a man wearing a captain's uniform.
Huh?
Paul looked back. The man wore some sort of SS officer's rank, probably a major or the equivalent.
Yes?
What are you doing there?
I am climbing up onto this tank's superstructure. I have to inspect the hatches on each tank to see that they're satisfactorily locked down. That's my job. I learned that if I do not check such work myself, the men under me will become lax.
You will let me see your orders now.
The man in the Nazi uniform was slightly built, blonde-haired, dark-eyed, sallow-complected, as if he never got out into the fresh air. Paul debated his possible courses of action. He was, after all, looking for a diversion.
Just a moment. While I'm up here, I'll check this hatch.
Paul turned his back to the man, clambering up the superstructure to the hatch itself. He looked back. The Nazi just stood there on the deck, hands on his hips.
Looks like he's gonna leap into dance.
Paul opened the hatch with some difficulty. The lock proved tricky, but the hatch weighed considerably less than he expected. Using his body to shield the work of his hands, he reached under his tunic and pulled the charge from the hook-and-pile fastener belt he wore. He flipped back the safety cover, set the toggle switch, and closed the cover. Then Paul dropped the charge down into the tank's interior. He stood to his full height and closed the hatch. As he looked back, the Nazi had been joined by two land pirates.
You will show me your orders, and you will show me what you placed inside the tank!
Paul was still turned away from the Nazi and the other two men. His hands closed on the butts of the Browning High Powers beneath his jacket. He turned around.
Sure I will.
Paul dropped both land pirates flanking the Nazi. There was total silence on the deck for a split second. The Nazi looked up at him, incredulous. Paul Rubinstein pointed both Browning High Powers at the Nazi's chest.
Go home, pal!
Gunfire hammered against the tank's superstructure. But Paul had jumped clear, running toward the cover of the other tanks. In a few seconds, if a bullet didn't catch him, he'd be protected enough to activate the detonator and send shrapnel flying all over the deck. John killed one of the two land pirates with his knife, then placed the muzzle of his suppressor-fitted 6906 against the forehead of the second.
Where's Martin Zimmer?
In the chief's meeting room, probably.
The chief?
The boss, you know.
What's his name?
We just call him chief, that's all.
All right, this meeting room. Is it where the chief briefs you on your raids and everything?
Yeah.
What's on?
What?
What's on, I said. Is there a raid planned?
Something big. They got Eden Army guys here and some of the Nazis, too.
Martin's in the briefing room, then. Where is that?
The man gave excellent directions, and true to his word, John didn't kill him, just slipped him an injection from the kit in his musette bag, putting him to sleep for a few hours. Quickly, because time might already be up for Michael, John moved through the maze of fuel tanks toward a staircase that would take him up to the level of the briefing room. Michael Rourke, 12 guards surrounding him, waited in what looked like an enormous briefing room, a table long enough to comfortably handle 24 people at its center. Maps of the Americas hung on the stone walls. Next to those maps hung a detailed map of the wildlands, including positions marked in large circled X's. This was a war room. At the sound of a door opening, Michael turned to his right. 7 men entered, one of them a land pirate, 2 in black uniforms with swastika armbands on the sleeve, 3 more in Eden field uniforms, each wearing the rank of a colonel or better. The 7th man wore civilian casual clothes. He stopped and faced Michael.
You must be Michael. What a pleasant surprise. Or are you John?
Michael stood, dumbfounded.
You look like me.
Martin Zimmer smiled.
Or is it that I look like you? Really, we both look enough like John Rourke to be John Rourke, don't we? You are Michael, I take it. John would probably have had something intensely doctrinaire to say.
A beeper sounded faintly. Martin Zimmer took a small communications device from his belt and raised it to his ear.
Excuse me a moment. This is Martin.
Oh, have they really?
Probably just the relatives stopping by. No, damn it! Don't let them get one of the helicopters airborne!
He tossed the communicator onto the table.
Annie and Paul and Natalia, I assume. And John, causing some trouble with the fortresses. But 3 or 4 people couldn't cause that much trouble, even Rourke's. What was the plan, Michael? You don't mind if I call you that, do you? Who the hell are you? I'm Martin Zimmer! And I'm about to take over the world. Nice of you to stop by, to congratulate me, no doubt. Who are you, damn it? Why do you look like...
Like you? Like your father?
Where is your father, Michael? Was this some sort of diabolical plan to get in and assassinate me? That was the general idea, I think. Well, it didn't work. If John is lurking around somewhere, ready to spring out and do something heroic, he'll find he's shit out of luck. I have him outnumbered and outwitted. The only way out of here would be with one of the fortresses, which he won't get. And he'd never leave you behind, which means he'll be showing up...
The door through which Martin Zimmer and the 6 other men had entered opened.
Just about now?
Martin Zimmer wheeled toward him. The other men in the room, the 12 who accompanied Michael and the 6 who entered with Martin Zimmer, turned toward the door as well. Michael stepped back, drawing both Berettas, ready to go down in a hail of gunfire.
Daddy!
Michael held his pistols, but realized his hands were shaking. Not counting Martin Zimmer, there were 18 enemy personnel in the room. At any second, someone would start shooting. This was it, unless his father had something up his sleeve. From where he stood, he could see Martin Zimmer and John Rourke. They were identical in features and coloring and height, except for their clothes, each the mirror image of the other, as he was their image. No one spoke. Michael couldn't stand it anymore.
Who the hell are you, damn it?
Martin Zimmer didn't look at him, only at John Rourke.
I'm your long-lost brother! After you both drop your weapons, maybe Mike, you and I can go outside and toss around a ball or something with old Dad here. And then Dad can tell me all about the birds and the bees or how to field strip a weapon.
Do you have Diedrich Zimmer's surgical skills, Martin? Because if you do, you can save your mother's life.
My mother? Oh, Mom's not well, is she?
There's a bullet in her brain that Diedrich Zimmer put there.
Tell me he isn't my brother, Dad! Tell me he isn't my brother, Dad!
John, apparently expecting this all along, seemed very calm. Didn't even answer him.
He is not the infant Diedrich Zimmer killed more than a century ago when he escaped from that redoubt in the Andes. That little boy was Lieutenant Martha Larrymore's child. Born the same day you were, wasn't it? Diedrich Zimmer took both infants out of the hospital the night he firebombed it and got Sarah and me.
I don't know the woman's name, but you guessed right, Dad. I'm really impressed. Now, since you could never get out of here alive, hand me those slick-looking pistols of yours. Call it my inheritance, Dad. I have a war to start.
Michael Rourke's fingers tightened against the triggers of his Berettas. This would be it.
And Zimmer used cryogenics, didn't he? He wanted a real world for you to conquer, one full of people. So he used cryogenic sleep until population caught up. That's why Dodd and his successors farmed babies. That's why you still do it. No fun ruling an empty planet. But Diedrich Zimmer's still alive.
He wouldn't miss this. He's gotta be alive.
Give me the guns, Daddy dear. They belong in my fucking museum, just like you belong in the grave.
For a moment, Michael almost shouted at his father, because his father rolled both Scoremasters in his hands and offered them butts forward to Martin. But then the momentary sickness Michael Rourke felt in the pit of his stomach, a momentary lightheadedness, was gone, replaced by an adrenaline rush. A smile crossed his lips. Martin reached for the guns. John's hands dropped slightly. The guns moved in his fingers as if they somehow had a life of their own. A double road agent spin. John and Michael opened fire into anything that moved. A bullet tore across Michael's left thigh and he stumbled to his left knee, but kept firing. Michael saw a blur of movement. His father pulled the 6-inch barreled 44 Magnum out. Then suddenly Martin was in front of him like a shield.
Drop your guns or he's dead!
Don't listen to him! He wouldn't kill his son!
A tightness came into Michael's throat, not from the pain in his left leg, but from what his father said in the next second.
That man over there is my son!
You could have been what you want.
Michael leaned back against the massive table leg, keeping the revolver and the one Beretta that still had a few rounds in the magazine trained on the 10 men who were still alive, some of them wounded. The others dropped their guns and raised their hands. In seconds, half the land pirates in the stronghold would be beating down the doors to the briefing room. John smiled.
I heard your end of that radio conversation, Martin. You're gonna get to meet the rest of the family, all right. Because they'll realize that we can't get one of the fortresses out of here, so they'll take one of the helicopters and land it right in the courtyard. Reunion time, Martin.
John pressed the muzzle of the 44 Magnum Smith & Wesson revolver against Martin Zimmer's right temple. Michael changed magazines in his pistols, giving himself a few seconds before he tried to stand. With less grace than she liked, Natalia got the craft airborne. For a moment terrified that with the low ceiling clearance above her in this vast hangar-sized garage complex, she would hit and crash the machine, killing them all. Paul and Annie huddled inside the open fuselage door, hurling anti-personnel grenades in the machine's wake, firing the door gun as Natalia let the gunship slip. The main rotor started to drag. She increased power. The gunship's arc changed. The craft accelerated so rapidly that for an instant she thought she would crash them into the structure's ceiling. But she brought the machine level, banking as she cleared the doorway and was into the open. There was no chance to try to disable the gunships left behind. She started to climb.
John and Michael don't realize that this is what we're up to. You and Annie pull out. I'll go in and you back me up with some of those missiles. Make a real mess. And then get the hell out of here before they send up some more choppers after us.
As much as she didn't like the idea of being protected, Paul made sense. If they were all captured or killed, then there would be no chance for any survivors to be freed or the dead to be avenged. They grossly miscalculated the manpower of the land pirates, but there was no intelligence data to indicate that Martin Zimmer was about to start a war. Natalia banked the helicopter to starboard in a long arc, checking the arming of her weapon systems.
Paul, help me up here! Annie, be ready by that door if we go in!
I'm ready.
Paul slid into the co-pilot seat beside her.
What do you want me to do?
You read the same captured manuals I did. Try to arm the missiles.
All right.
She could see the courtyard now, a crowd of figures that were indistinguishable at her current altitude coming out of the main structure within the courtyard.
Annie, be ready with that machine gun.
Ready.
Paul, hurry those missiles.
I'm trying.
Natalia started descending, coming down in a tight circle over the courtyard. There were men on the walls, armed men, but no one was shooting at her. Through the chin bubble, she could make out something about the figures below her. Some women, mostly men. She thought she could see John or Michael. It was Michael, and he was limping. Now she could see details clearly. About 24 women were in the courtyard, dressed in tattered rags, herded together, Michael urging them along. And there was a veritable army of land pirates and Eden personnel, some in black uniforms as well. She saw John, but blinked. She looked back, saw Michael. John and Michael and someone John had a gun on who looked just like both of them.
Who is that? He looks like... Oh, my God! Just be ready with that door gun!
Missiles armed! I'm going aft!
Right, Paul!
She let the machine turn a full 360 degrees on its main rotor. Then she eased slightly forward on her control stick and skated the machine down about 25 yards from the women.
How many people will this thing hold?
Supposedly two fully equipped squads with light weapons.
These raggedly dressed creatures were some of the captured women. It would be tight getting them aboard, but she wouldn't leave any of them behind. She saw Michael clearly now, saw him limping but otherwise unhurt. John's left forearm was clamped tight over Martin's neck, his left hand knotted on Martin's right ear, the muzzle of his gun against Martin's right temple. Paul and Annie were in the fuselage doorway. Paul helped the women inside. Annie crouched behind the door gun, ready to use it. Through the cockpit bubble, he could see Natalia. Michael limped past his father.
Come on, Dad!
John knew what he would do if he could do it. It would be the only way to save Sarah's life, to bring her back. He was grateful that this offspring of their bodies didn't know him any better. As John edged himself and Martin back toward the gunship, Martin tried to break away.
You do it! I'll blow your brains out.
He would never have shot any man that way, least of all this man.
I got him!
The muzzle of Michael's revolver went to Martin's head. Michael and Paul hauled Martin up into the machine. John Rohr jumped aboard.
Get us out of here, Natalia!
The machine lurched, rose, slipped to port a little, and was airborne. They wouldn't be followed, because they had Martin, and Martin was their leader. The enemy, the armed forces of Eden, the Nazis who aided them, the land pirates, would expect a deal, a bargain. John remembered the words of Winston Churchill when Churchill commented on making an alliance with Stalin to defeat Hitler. John would not make an alliance with the devil, but he would bargain for the devil's life.
We made it.
John said nothing, just reached out and took his son Michael's hand for a moment. His son. Survivalist The Legend is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1991, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Hazelford, Mort Shelby, Nanette Savard, Eric Messner, Michael Glenn, M.B. Van Dorn, Stephen Carpenter, Michael John Casey, David Coyne, Colleen Delaney, Katie Foster, Elizabeth Jernigan, Ren Casey, Sonny Lasky, Dylan Lynch, Tony Nam, Richard Rowan, and Tom Simpson. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Timothy Lynch. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Christopher Rowan. Graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler, Greg Reinfeld, and Christopher Rowan. Book adapted for graphic audio by Timothy Lynch. With original music by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for Ryder Stacey's Doomsday Warrior, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another thrilling title in Graphic Audio.
Mr. Fury, sir, I'm the Reverend Milcher.
Reverend, what can I do for you folks?
We are only 8 wagons and a small gather of livestock, but I am certain that we can attract a few more fellow pilgrims. When it's known that we have procured the great Jedediah Fury as our wagon master.
Kansas City, Missouri. Great jumping off point for wagon trains headed into the Western Territories. Jedediah Fury, his son Jason and daughter Jenny, lead a group of pilgrims from all walks of life across the Great Plains to the Land of Promise, California. But common purpose doesn't always lead to harmony.
Let me alone, you big bully!
Hey, you, let him go.
Get lost!
Gosh!
What's your name, kid?
Milcher. Thomas Milcher.
I'm Jason Fury.
You all know me, my dear friends. And I say we should divest ourselves of the members of the Hebrew race. These crucifiers of Christ.
Folks, we've all throwed in together in order to make this difficult trip across the wilderness. And that means leaving our petty bigotries behind us. Everybody got that?
Circle the wagons in tight. Men, get your guns out!
Quick! Get those cattle and horses down here! Dear God,
Fury's town!
It's not.
I'm afraid so, son. Your father took a lance through the lungs. There was nothing I could do.
Jedediah Fury, wagon master and father, is gone. But Jason has no time to grieve. It's now his job to get the pilgrims to California, come hell or high water.
It's Carrie English! Her wagon's going in the creek!
God damn it, Fury! Do something!
Chrissy! Chrissy, you in there?
Is that you, Mr. Fury?
Chrissy, honey! Come here! We're gonna take a little swim.
After many more trials and tribulations, the wagon train reaches Arizona Territory, where the weary pilgrims, notional as ever, decide not to go to California after all.
Tomorrow I shall consecrate this land, and we shall also name our new town.
I vote we name it for Jason's daddy.
You're going to name the town Jedediah?
No, boy, Fury. And we'll build it right here, right where we are standing.
Megan?
You're not going to stay, are you?
Not any longer than I have to. I'll stay long enough to help get the first buildings up and make sure you're settled in, but then I'm going. Do you understand, Megan?
You love me, Jason. And I love you, too.
But Megan...
Good night, Jason!
Oh, crud.
Hit the Trail West with a new series by William W. Johnstone with J.A. Johnstone. A Town Called Fury. In graphic audio.
Kyler Stern has rejected the assassin's life.
We've got a contract for you. 50,000 Gunders for one kill, Kyler. With that much... You can take Aline annually anywhere. You'll have done the world a good turn, and you'll never have to work again. It's just one last job.
There's always one last job. I'm finished.
The God King's successful coup has left Kyler's master, Derzo Blint, dead and buried.
Oh, I've been having a little party, celebrating.
What are you celebrating?
Derzo Blint is dead!
Tired of it all, he is starting over. New city, new friends, and a new profession.
Kyla, there are always going to be people so bad that we think they deserve to die. I don't know. What I do know is what you've told me about what killing has done to your soul. No matter what good it seems to do for the world, it destroys you. I can't watch that, Kyla. I won't. I care about you too much.
All right. We should be able to leave in the morning.
But the beckoning will of the Shadow soon comes to call on Kyler once again.
Logan's alive. He's in the hole.
Logan's alive?
Every day, the chances that Logan will be discovered get worse.
You want me to break into the hole and save Logan?
I want you to rescue Logan. And then I want you to assassinate the God King.
Kyler is faced with an agonizing choice. Will he give up the Way of Shadows and live in peace? Or will he risk everything by taking on the ultimate hit?
Look at yourself! I know this hit is impossible. I'm sending you after a god. But if anyone in the world can do it, it's you. You were made for this, Kyler. Some things are bigger than your happiness. You can give hope to an entire nation.
It'll only cost me everything.
Will Kyler see the light when his world is shrouded in shadows? Find out in Shadow's Edge, the thrilling second part of the Night Angel trilogy. Available now in graphic audio.
It's good to have you back, my friend.
It's bad to be back.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.